Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 2nd of February. The Obama administration is planning to make changes to No Child Left Behind. He presented his 2011 budget yesterday, and there were three very basic changes. One, scraping of the benchmarks that are the cornerstone of No Child Left Behind. It would also mean getting rid of the 2014 deadline for all students to be declared proficient. The administration would also like to replace the annual yearly progress benchmarks with new standards that are based on college and career readiness. Those have yet to be developed. And the administration wants to shift how federal education dollars are dispersed. Currently, the funding is driven by a formula that the president would like to see that system include more competitive grants. We're going to talk about proposed changes to No Child Left Behind and whether indeed this law needs significant changes. Our guest is Professor Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. He comes from a long line of teachers in his family, and we're happy to have him as our guest this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I know many of you are educators and know a great deal about No Child Left Behind, and hopefully those of you who are in education who aren't teaching today can talk about how No Child Left Behind has affected your teaching and your school and the kinds of changes you would like to see in the law. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Correa, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm very glad to be here, and good morning.
Good morning to you. There were a lot of educators who felt that No Child Left Behind created significant problems for them, that that high standards and accountability for learning was something that was to be applauded, but a lot of teachers complained that they were teaching to the test all the time. Did they have justification for their worries?
I think that the results of No Child Left Behind remind me, I have a brother-in-law who sells software, and he's always saying that it's exactly what they asked for and not what they wanted. And I think with No Child Left Behind, many people were saying that these types of expectations and measures have to be in place, and we have to hold people accountable. And then when they saw the detail and the evidence and then the outcomes and then the punishments or sanctions, and, of course, the lack of funding to meet those, the cry was loud, and then it became sort of down along political lines, too. So political groups like NEA and AFT, to a lesser extent, the teacher unions representing professional educators, really became vocal critics of No Child Left Behind. And so the result was that it was a cornerstone, or at least one of a few cornerstones, for Obama to be elected, because he was able to tap into that discontent with the Bush administration in a very specific way. And since evidence shows teachers do tend to support Democratic candidates a little bit more, it was a very strong political decision, very effective. And now, of course, the Obama administration has to try to deliver on this change that they're talking about. And maybe in education, as opposed to healthcare, they can actually build a slightly broader coalition and actually get a few Republicans to vote for this. So they're hoping that this works out for them politically very much, too.
Mm-hmm. What do you see? We have an outline. We don't have a lot of specifics yet about grants or how they would judge an assessment. What do you see as the major changes to No Child Left Behind? Is it nullification of the deadline for proficiency? Is it not having to look at yearly benchmarks again? What is it?
I think one of the things that they're trying to do is to remove the parts that they considered, and certainly the complaint from the public or professional educators more loudly, the more onerous aspects of it, which labeled schools failing schools. And many schools said, wow, we're doing 90 things great. We're doing 4 things not up to the standard. Oh, my gosh, we're a failing school. Now, it was also called adequate yearly progress. That sounds, you know, that's not quite as bad. But boy, you know, it was a label that many fine, excellent school districts who perhaps fell down in a particular category didn't like. So that's one thing. Now, another thing, just to kind of step back for a second, you will also not hear anybody in the Obama administration actually use the terms "No Child Left Behind," with the exception of the president. And again, they want to use their own vocabulary, their own terminology.
Sure.
So, race to the top, because once again,
yes.
who can disagree with that? So, so one of the things that they're trying to do is make it more. They're trying to collapse a number of the funding programs that anybody listening would be familiar with some of these. A lot of the education money is distributed to schools in title grants. Title I deals with poverty and a few other broad areas. Title IX, some people might be familiar with to a lesser extent, that deals with gender equity in sports and schools, also including colleges and universities. But it's the title money. And then within those title funds, boy, there are line items, even down to funding for the development of school counselors. And so what the Obama administration is trying to do is collapse those into broader categories, and then to be able to allow either districts or states to take that money and put it where they believe it would have the greatest use to match the goals that Race to the Top is attempting to emphasize.
And that's a significant change, because I'm a little confused here. The grants used to be just given to a state, but with an earmark for poorer districts or poor students?
Well, Title I is relatively a significant amount of money, and it was also the program in which school lunch programs are funded, free and reduced lunches, a variety of things that deal with students with low-income poverty. And so Milwaukee, for example, receives a great deal of Title I money, not relative to their whole budget, but they need it.
Yes.
They need that kind of money. Now, an interesting wrinkle with this is Vermont does not accept any federal money
really?
In those title programs in education, because they do not have those high-need students within the state. And so so it also explains, by the way, why Bernie Sanders is an independent, because you don't necessarily have to have that constant flow of money. But it's a relatively small amount that the state or that the federal government provides for education in the United States. It's about 10 cents on the dollar. And so it's an interesting case where, you know, a lot of districts can't afford to lose that. They can't afford to lose their, you know, funding programs for reading or, you know, school lunch programs. Relatively small amount, but that's how the federal government has been able to get them to comply with aspects of No Child Left Behind.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so, you know, so it's been very powerful, yet relative, it's a rather small amount, but they just don't have that kind of financial wiggle room.
Yeah. So tell me, what is the significant change in terms of how students will be assessed, how schools will be assessed? Are we looking at a different kind of testing? Are we getting rid of all those tests?
Well, of course, in Wisconsin, there's a group that Superintendent Evers has formed to be able to look at getting rid of the Wisconsin Knowledge and Concepts, WKCE, exam. That announcement has not yet been made. But actually, you know, there are so many parallel paths moving right now that I think you could ask five people and get 10 different answers. In general, what is they are trying to do, and I think this is the significant part of Race to the Top, we have collected since 2002, maybe 2003, immense volumes of data on student performance, just amazing amounts, and nobody's quite sure what to do with it. And it's we have these reports issued sometimes at the end of the school year. Anybody listening will know that, you know, you get your child's performance on the KCE exam, usually sometime late April or May. And so it's really more for the district to be able to see how they're doing than individual student performance. But districts have this data, and historically, schools do not have a CFO or a CIO, a chief information officer. And so, you know, teachers are trained to teach, but exactly using data to inform teaching and the subtleties and the differences And to collect all of this data, wow, you know, graduation rates and just on and on, those systems aren't in place. So I think what Race to the Top is trying to do is to say, we need to have a manageable, significant, comprehensive, nationwide database to collect this. And in fact, one of the articles I read called it a cradle-to-grave database. To be able to understand how students are progressing through the system and where they're going and where the money is going. And, boy, there's a project. So that's a big aspect of this, of the Race to the Top money.
And let's talk a little bit more about Race to the Top. The administration has required states that are involved in this to develop the capability to evaluate teachers based on student test data. And I know that this is a controversial thing as well. Two questions here. One is, does a positive evaluation result in merit pay for teachers? And number two, what is the assessment? Is it just based on student tests, a different kind of test, the test they take in class, or what? What is the component that deals with testing and student achievement, and how does that figure into Race to the Top?
And that's excellent, because one of the aspects, too, is the Obama administration, and this is one that's a little bit, you know, politically trickier, because they really are wanting to have a more black and white, or at least trying to move towards that evaluation of teachers based on the performance of their students. And so that's exactly what you're getting at with the question. Now, the problem is that the tying teacher performance to student evaluation or student quality of their test performance, that has not yet really been decided. In Wisconsin, the law that was passed back a few months ago really just said it can be included in teacher evaluation, but the extent to which it is included and the manner in which it, you know, factors in a percentage, is it 50% of your evaluation, 25%, who even knows what that model would be, is not decided, which is one reason why the Wisconsin School Board Association, interestingly, came out opposed to the law. Not because they didn't think it was a good idea. They just said, this is just a straw man. It's not a real thing. We need to put meaningful test scores in, not just you can include it as if determining students' eye color. So they didn't see it as very meaningful. The assessments that they're using, this is another parallel track here. We have apparently a lot of train cars running. The idea is with this is that people are now pushing for, and they have been for a number of years, nationwide assessments that would be a common core of standards, and therefore then Southern Arkansas students in Little Rock, which is not in Southern Arkansas, but forget my geography, would be evaluated on the exact same test as students in upstate New York. Now, that is a long way to go politically. But the idea would be that it would be some reliable and valid measure of student performance, perhaps like our existing WKCE, or perhaps what would even come out afterwards.
Is it a good idea, do you think?
I think it makes perfect sense to involve student performance on some type of assessments to teacher evaluations. I think that makes perfect sense. Of course, the trick is the extent to which you address this. Now, one of the neat things that I really like that I've heard an Obama Education Department person share, in fact, this was on campus at St. Norbert College, she shared this with us, is that the idea that we might look at is maybe we look at student progress from one year to the next, and not necessarily that they are at this blanket benchmark that all students are expected to achieve. For example, you might have an ELL student who is just learning English.
Sure.
And to expect them to perform at the same level as native speakers in fourth grade would not be realistic. But if you can chart a 20% growth in reading capacity or whatever, math skills, from third grade to fourth grade, wow, that's great. Now, maybe comparatively, it's still lower than the native speakers, but look at this progress. So I think they're trying to, in this data system, there's room to be able to fine-tune it more to show the idea of progress. And again, that gets back, loops right around to one of the first things we talked about, less onerous, and it's an incentive to be able to encourage schools to collect this data and use it, and not a disincentive to be able to have them trudge in like a death march to take the tests all the time. And then teachers will be more likely to plug this data in, use the data, make adjustments for students' performance.
And then you've got that thing that you just can't measure is how much enthusiasm and excitement did your teacher generate in giving you a love of history or of literature that will be with you for your whole life and enrich your life and enrich your community. How in the world do you measure that?
Oh, you know, and I absolutely. I mean, there's not a listener that can't be smiling about somebody that did that for them. And it's funny because one of the things that Race to the Top is encouraging is the whole idea of charter schools. And most charter schools do not have as their primary focus strong academic performance will be measured by standardized tests. They have these ideas of whether they're project-based or environmentally focused or, you know, there's any number of ones. Up in the North Woods near Minocqua, they are starting a project-based school. And the idea is to be able to motivate students to get interested and take ownership of their learning. And so charter schools, you know, interestingly, again, it's another one of those funny parallel tracks. They're almost saying, we're going to get the academic performance, but we're going to get it by meeting individual student needs. And so it's a dichotomy that, you know, one looking at this would sort of say, boy, you know, are all these hands talking to each other? And but the charter schools are being encouraged by the Obama administration because they are working for the most part. And it's exciting, and it gets people really, really excited and interested in being involved in education.
Phone calls for our guest, Professor Steve Correa. He is Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. And Professor Correa is with us this hour to talk about what they're not fully developed yet, but the general outline we're getting from the Obama administration as to what kind of education reform they would like to see in this country and what would the significant changes be in No Child Left Behind. Here's our phone number. Join us. We would love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about several studies recently released on sleep. One of them shows that indeed older people do not need as much sleep. We'll talk about the importance of a good night's sleep to your athletic performance, your performance on the job, and a number of other recent studies. Our guest, Dr. Tucker Woodson, professor in chief of the Division of Sleep Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin Sleep Disorders Program. All right, phone calls, 800-486-8655 is our number, and we'll start with Lisa from Appleton. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for having me on the air.
Sure.
I think this is a great topic to be discussed because I've been concerned, about 50 years old, and I've been concerned a long time about how English and spelling and things have gotten in this country in general, and I have two stepchildren who are wonderful kids. However, they're getting B pluses in Wisconsin in English and cannot spell, and in fact, one child who's in sixth grade, I tested this last summer and could only get 30% fourth grade words correct.
Hmm.
And I'm very disturbed by this, and something needs to be done because this doesn't help us in a world economy. So I'm not, if you have any questions for the professor.
All right, Professor Correa.
Well, and again, you know, it's always sort of interesting to respond when you're dealing with individual skills. You know, let me try another tact on this. It's an interesting argument. 100 years ago, school teachers used to have to know how to build a fire in order to be certified to teach. They also had to know how to tend coal. And there's a variety of other things. Now, I'm certainly not saying, and just like our old president used to say, let me be perfectly clear, I think that spelling is important. However, we actually do have technology that does that. And we even have technology that allows people to be able to speak and have text appear on the page. Maybe people have used Dragon or they're familiar with it. So while I'm not saying that spelling isn't important, we might look at how we teach spelling. Now, the fact that the caller from Appleton there is talking about their child or stepchild being in sixth grade, you know, there's some brain physiology research that shows we probably shouldn't be teaching spelling until about fourth or fifth grade, that there actually isn't the brain physiology to understand the idea of spelling and rules and those kind of things. So perhaps that should be the grade that we start teaching that in, as opposed to the drill and kill of first grade and second grade. Secondly, I think that we might say that there's fourth grade spelling words. Some people could spell those in second. Some people might not be able to spell them till sixth. Broadly speaking, some people might agree with that. But what I would try to do is put that in a larger picture of sentence and composition and communication skills, and perhaps those other things are not quite there. But, you know, schools can concentrate on those, and those are things that are attractive to schools to be able to talk about because those relate to fairly good standardized test performance. But if we look at broader student skills, I would argue that spelling can be taught, but it's always within context, because just having students do spelling words, that's not exciting. And we could sit over them and get them to spell those words correctly. So some of it's motivation, some of it's within context. Some of it, frankly, it sounds like there's a very wonderful parent or step-parent there
yes.
that's paying a lot of attention to their child's performance, and that is good. And, of course, in all those cases, just like your mechanic and your doctor, talk to the teacher and find out, because I hate to bring this up, but, frankly, there might be another issue at work here that might be stopping that child's performance.
Thank you so much for the call. Here's an email. Teachers have so little support for making real change. A child at our school was removed for not participating in standardized tests. When confronted for not participating, he began screaming that he didn't have to do it and he didn't care about the results. There was nothing the teacher could do but remove him from the class. Multiply that by extreme poverty and family dysfunction in failing schools. My son works in the Milwaukee area. He has 8 kids in one class who have learning disabilities and no aids or help. A student who hit a teacher was returned to class minutes later. There is nothing that teachers can do to force achievement, but they are responsible for all.
Certainly violence and those kind of things are unacceptable under any circumstance. I think everyone would agree with that. Certainly teachers having the support of administration and understanding how their classrooms work, that's very important. Now, I have to say, though, I find it quite interesting if a child would decide with an act of civil disobedience to not take a standardized test. I don't know that I would decide that that child is in line for punishment. I'd say that that child is exercising a very conscious decision. Now, of course, we all have responsibilities and outcomes from our actions. It's not, okay, feel free and go to the playground. But we have conscientious objectors all over our system. And I only say half facetiously, how dare this child think that he has control or she over his life? this might actually be a wonderful point of discussion. You know, it worked for Gandhi. It's worth, you know, I don't know that I would immediately dismiss that. I think that's an intriguing idea.
It is intriguing.
And
what would the consequences be if a whole school decided all the students or 90% of them were not taking these tests? Would they, under No Child Left Behind, be suffering severe consequences, no funding, maybe a closing of the school?
Oh, wouldn't that be, boy, yeah.
To begin
with, you'd have to bring in a lot of anison for administrators.
Right.
And again, I don't know how that cascading effect might be. Yeah, theoretically, and this is something that we might be able to deal with later, but No Child Left Behind is still technically in effect. So those AYP, Adequate Yearly Progress issues, are still in effect. So theoretically, if enough of these happened 3 years in a row by these subgroups, yes, there could be some significant issue that the school would happen to have to deal with. However, in the short run, I think we might have, you know, a student that can actually learn to think for himself. Unless, of course, he's just being obstinate, in which case that's usually the case when you disagree with someone. But
we go to Brian from Onalaska. Hi, Brian.
Oh, hi. It's Byron.
Oh, Byron. Hi, Byron.
That's okay. My question is, I'm a motivational speaker, and I speak in high schools all over Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. And I hear a lot of complaints about No Child Left Behind, and in general, the specific complaints are very well-founded, in my opinion. But I also hear a lot of teachers having this general resistance to accountability. And I'm wondering what the professors comment on it. I read recently most states don't even evaluate their teachers at any point after the 10-year process is complete. Most of us in the real world, we're held accountable on so many levels, and I just would like to hear what the professor thinks about that. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thanks, Byron.
Well, certainly, you know, broadly speaking, teacher evaluation is very uneven. Even across a very strong educational state like Wisconsin. Usually in smaller districts, it's a principal. If they are lucky enough to have an assistant principal or an associate principal, they may also be involved in that teacher evaluation. But he's exactly right. After the tenure process, and I think it's kind to say it's uneven, in some cases it has been decades since teachers have been formally evaluated with an evaluation instrument and then a pre- and post-conversation and sort of the industry standard for doing that. And, yes, teachers do somewhat bristle at that. Teaching is a very, oddly enough, solitary activity in terms of the door being closed and you're responsible for the academic and emotional and development of all those students. Some states have gone more to, again, those standardized test performances, and some states have put a lot more effort into training administrators to be able to evaluate teachers. And Race to the Top has a whole area of provision about training administrators to turn around failing schools. Now, an aspect of that is effective evaluation of teacher performance. And so, you know, Obama administration is looking at that and trying to put those programs into place, because we might have some examples, but we don't really have programs. But back to Byron's original observation, no, we're terrifically uneven across that. And sometimes the person even evaluating the teacher may have less educational experience than the teacher that they're evaluating. So, peer evaluation and observation is not encouraged in schools, mainly because it can be very difficult to be able to do. Hey, I'm teaching my class. How can I watch yours? But schools that have put in an infrastructure to be able to help teachers work with each other and develop that, and not just summative evaluation, but formative to develop those skills, they're relatively few and far between. The good old lab schools of two generations ago used to encourage that, but no, it's not an effective system, quite frankly.
What about student evaluation? Is that ever on target?
Boy, that's interesting, because I teach at a college that puts a lot of emphasis on student evaluation of teaching. In fact, at St. Norbert College, we call that their nickname Soots. And those carry a lot of weight, rightly or wrongly. Some evaluation has, or assessment of those, have... It's kind of a mixed bag. You know, sometimes it is a result of easier grading, but not always. What they tend to do is, if you have a collection of data that shows trends, it might provide you some insight, but you have to collect this data sort of longitudinally. But clearly, students should be able to provide feedback in some way for their teachers, and not with the teacher standing over them saying, wait a minute, check the nice box. That's not the idea. But some school districts do that, but not many. In college, it's very much the norm.
Yes.
Yeah.
An email, Carol from Green Bay. How does the process of tenure affect the quality of teachers at the elementary and high school level?
Well, most districts use the terminology, just because I'll use the terminology that's used there, of a continuing contract. Now, theoretically, it's a little bit different. Tenure is kind of a higher education thing. But what it means is that given constants, like funding, enrollment, those types of things, the teacher would then be given a contract relative to the continuation of their license. So if their license would expire, they wouldn't continue. So there's all kind of steps and grades in that. Nobody graduating now will be able to get a lifetime contract anymore. That just doesn't exist anymore. They're still pending evaluation and those kind of things. Very few people that are currently teaching, but some, have lifetime licenses. Interestingly enough, I have a lifetime license from the state of Ohio. I don't know if that makes me old enough or lucky enough, but I graduated in the early 80s, and that was all I needed from that. The idea is that the reality of it is once teachers get that continuing contract, they sort of aren't on the radar screen of the administrators anymore unless something puts it there, mm-hmm. some issue. And because we have so many new teachers coming in, you know, anywhere between, well, it's changed a little bit, drop because of economic issues. But, you know, in normal years, it's 20 to 25% of the teachers every year in some school districts change over, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. But, you know, if you're looking even at 20% of the teachers, boy, they need to not only be shown where the Xerox machine is, mm-hmm. You need to help them with everything. And so that's why Wisconsin has paid some attention to the mentoring process and connections with higher education and helping those new teachers to be able to acclimate within their school districts. But back to the emailer's original question, I think it was Carol from Green Bay.
Yes, it was.
It sort of falls by the wayside because there's so many other things to do, and we shall assume quality on this person's part.
Dan from Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I've got some of the same questions I think you've already touched on, but when we link student performance on standardized tests to the teacher's performance in this race to the top process, I think, as you've outlined already, we have to be very careful about doing that. And one of the things I don't think we've touched enough on in this discussion is what's the parents' involvement in their child's education? How much do they value the education and put that forward? You know, the child that resisted taking the test, I bet the environment at home wasn't the greatest for that child to even value education. So there's a danger, and we sometimes demonize teachers and say they're the ones that are totally responsible for the education of our kids, and it's really the parents and the education of the community and importance our community places on it that really should be valued. So I'd just be curious about your comments on that.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, interesting. Of course, it's also possible that the parents may be involved in some aspects of political activism, and maybe the child picked that up. It's also possible he was just crabby. So, you know, we're not quite sure. Now, back to the other, though. He's very insightful, I think, that way. We have to be purposeful and measured in using standardized test scores to evaluate teacher performance, not because it's a bad idea, just because it can be a broad brushstroke that, again, may not show the subtlety and the nuance. Student progress is perhaps a more interesting way to be able to look at this. And that idea, again, it's not necessarily that you've reached a predetermined benchmark, the 2014 100%, which, you know, statistically is just mind-boggling. But the idea that your progress has continued, here's another way to also consider this. Education works as a team. Very few educators, though previously I said it's lonely in parts because you close the door, but, you know, you bring in a lot of people. It's like a really good medical team. There are support staff. There are special needs people. That child goes to music and art and et cetera. And they interact through the team through the day. So perhaps team and team planning and team interventions and then a rewarding of the team. Now, middle schools have been very strong at doing that, that team planning. So the fact that teaching can be solitary also means the system itself, or as a colleague of mine who's a graduate of Madison will always say, it's the school structure. Does the school structure provide that support? And then we have to reward that support, meaning the teachers, the group, or evaluate that support as to what's working, what's not working. And so, he's exactly correct. Some of that's that purposeful, that teasing out, that looking for that effect. Now, here's another part of that, and I mentioned that a little bit before. This is terrifically sophisticated analysis. And, boy, at the same time, you're making lesson plans, you're cleaning up from the kid that got ill, you're mm-hmm. checking who's late for class. It's a lot to do. I'm not saying teachers aren't capable. They are. But we have to do a school structure that allows for all of these needs to be met. And that's a lot for anybody to do.
We haven't talked another part of and the proposal here is not very flushed out, so I'm not sure what the administration means. But we've had word that they want to get all subgroups of students on track to college and career readiness. The growth of individual students toward that and the progress toward closing subgroup achievement gaps and graduation rates. Can you talk a little bit about, do you know more about what they mean by career readiness and college and that being a measurement of assessment?
Absolutely. And actually, if I could even loop back to the caller just then, one of the reasons that students don't do well in school, it's hard to always nail one specific one, but this is a great example. It's goals. Why am I doing what I'm doing? What is the purpose? And so, we always try to have students have a goal. And frankly, for some ninth graders, it's to get to 10th grade, and that's sort of okay. But what's the goal past school? So is higher education. And then what's the goal past that? Well, we want to get them into careers. And so what the Obama administration is trying to do, and I think this is where they deserve credit, and frankly, so does the Bush administration, because they have tried to shine a light on groups that have traditionally been ignored in school performance data, and, that's lower SES and special needs and that kind of thing. The idea here is to be able to have, for example, Appleton has a career academy as a charter school, and so it shows students in high school these connections that they can make into the community. And that's the idea, to be able to say you're going to continue to loop around, need training, go out to the career, need training, come back into education. And so your education isn't finite, it's constant and ongoing. And we need to have a system that tracks that and encourages that and makes it possible for students to be able to get into, whether it's community colleges or higher education of any type. And so they're trying to build into the system this encouragement of partnerships, perhaps with technical colleges, community colleges, the UW centers, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the idea, to make those connections, to have those goals, and have them be ongoing so that we don't just, it's not just graduation, that's critical, but it's then, and then beyond that, where are we trying to head?
Dan from Eau Claire, hi. Dan, are you there? Dan is gone. Bill from Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
This has been touched upon a couple times, and as a former tutor and many years ago in New York, a reading tutor with in a very poor neighborhood, it was amazing how much personal attention could do to help some of the children. And I was wondering, with so many young children or children that may have attention deficit disorders, I'm curious how many get under the radar, and secondly, whether proper identification, perhaps parent training for tutoring, might be a feasible project, at least to test in some schools. We're maybe all thinking about the movie The Blind Side, which is sort of a highly successful example of what personal contact can do, and maybe that's unrealistic, but I'm interested in how those, learning issues with a child can be met with by the state. I think there's probably a real difficulty there.
I think that's a great, the great observation that you make, and certainly your experience at being a tutor, speaks to that. It's personal attention. It's a teacher that maybe starts out simply knowing your name, knowing your story, knowing what you're interested in, having a better clue about how to motivate you, how to connect with you. And that's important. But by the way, anybody listening to this who runs their own business also knows that that's important. I mean, it's hard to do that, though. I have a colleague I think very highly of who describes education as we meet individual needs in group settings. And, boy, you know, that's sort of an odd way to be able to do that. However, the continued identification of students with special needs, that area is increasing, whether it's ADD, ADHD, autism, whatever the case it might be. And the caller may note, and anybody listening may know, when districts are looking at budget issues, there's almost always a cutting of a special education position. And, boy, you know, I wonder how they can do that. I suppose that causes me great concern. These are the children that need the attention. They're also, unfortunately, a squeaky wheel that doesn't always get the grease because they're sometimes a terrifically disenfranchised group. But these groups are being, you know, increasingly identified, and so those needs are another one in the cacophony of challenges that teachers have to be able to deal with. And you can see this menu of skills that teachers have to have every day. And so parents should count themselves lucky when they feel that their children are getting those needs, because we have lots of needs competing for very finite resources.
This hour of the program, we're talking about proposed changes to the No Child Left Behind Act. The president has not fully outlined what his ideas are, but given us a general idea of what they are. Our guest is Professor Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls. Brian is next from Milwaukee. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Dr. Steve.
Good morning.
Excuse me if I'm reiterating something. I came in a little late, but nonetheless, I think it's important to discuss the underpinning basis for the reason we need to learn English skills. That is that we think in English. We spend about half of our day in our head. And if you notice, folks, what we're thinking is English. And when we have those skills to describe ourselves, describe our world, describe our relationships, we have an implicit advantage to managing ourselves and becoming who we want to be. I think the premise of this was first identified by Dr. Noam Chomsky at MIT back in the mid-50s. And what he did is he found that there is a very special part of the brain that we're born with that actually gives us language skill. And that language skill is something that we're born with, innate. It's something that we express from day one. And we learn the first day by mirroring other people in our family and our friends. We learn how to become individuals and how to become members of our community. And those first 5 years are extremely important. That is when we learn the greatest amount of our linguistic skill and thus self-identity. Does that make sense?
Sounds like someone was paying attention in the lecture. That's very well done. I'm very impressed. What I might say is if I could sort of date you to somebody even earlier than that, and you probably are familiar with this, there was a Soviet psychologist by the name of Lev Vygotsky. And if you read Chomsky's stuff, and then you go back and look at Vygotsky's. Now, granted, I have to read it in translation. My Russian's a little rough. But what Vygotsky said was, language and the use of language and communicating is, by its very act, learning. And whether we communicate orally, written, interpretive dance, art, any kind of way that we communicate with other people, we are learning, and we learn social skills, and we learn values, and we learn how to get along, and we learn respect, and we learn all kinds of things through that interaction, through that discussion. And back to that earlier comment, I think that wonderful comment that you made, you're right. It's this thinking process. It's critical thinking. And what's the language we use? Well, of course, we learn English. So we have to be able to learn to think intelligently, critically, reflectively. And of course, now we're touching onto things like everybody from John Dewey to everybody that talked about critical thinking and reflection. So he's exactly correct. And what I would say then is the reason that we don't concentrate just on spelling is it sort of means we learn lose the forest for the trees, or the other way around, perhaps. The idea is that we have to be able to encourage students to interact and talk and think critically and be held accountable for their arguments. Oh, there's a wonderfully exciting dynamic classrooms and intergenerational conversations, and you bring in the community and you bring in people from different cultures. It's also like the wonderful 3 o'clock show here on Earth. And that's the idea. You find out how other people talk. And so if schools do that, lo and behold, we find that academic skills across the board rise and increase. And some charter schools are specifically built on this. So he's exactly right. Chomsky is wonderful to listen to and wonderful to read. These are ideas that are very embedded in people that are looking at progressive ideas and the good old progressive era of education. And those are wonderful suggestions. I think very exciting. You can tell by my voice. I like them.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Thanks, Dr. Brian, for your call. Diana from Reedsburg. Hi.
I was wondering how... when every year our school district in particular and many others have been struggling to balance their school budgets, how we can incorporate all these new things that we're supposed to do when the state continues to cut funding for schools and put schools like ours in the difficult position of closing elementary schools and increasing our class sizes, cutting programs, teachers, and other staff instead of focusing on all these new exciting things that we're supposed to be doing with the Race to the Top.
It's a $64,000 question. That's a big issue. Now, interestingly, I know of two specific school districts in Wisconsin, Merrill School District, Marathon County, just north of Wausau, and the Freedom School District in mostly Brown County, some Outagamie County in Wisconsin, have decided not to try for the Race to the Top funds. They've just said that the expectations and the requirements for the size of our district require a financial commitment that we cannot sustain. Because I think it's important for everybody to understand that these Race to the Top funds are finite. They're to put systems in place that then have to be supported by the school district, and that's the assessment collection and a variety of other things. And a number of districts have just said, we can't afford to do this in an ongoing basis, therefore it's disingenuous for us to be involved in this now. And I think even La Crosse, somebody over in the western part of the state, was also debating this. The school board was split, but they came down on the side of not deciding to go for the No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top funds. And yes, you know, you're right. Boy, we talk about competing resources. And on the one hand, we have this drive for innovation. And on the other hand, we have people looking for money to stop the roof from leaking and to keep the lights on.
Yeah. It's a perennial problem. Thanks, Diana, for the call. From Facebook, Marilyn writes, why aren't all students tested for yearly progress? There are a lot of students in private and parochial schools go through these schools, and when they drop out, their problems are given to the public schools.
Well, I guess the answer is in the question. Because they are private and parochial, they are not subject, as laws are currently understood, to be able to do, for example, in Wisconsin, the WKCE test. Now, I happen to know some Catholic schools in northeastern Wisconsin that do have their students do those tests for comparative purposes, to be able to show that we are indeed doing that. But no, they're not required to do that. Now, I do know, and actually I can even speak to a couple real specific examples, of students that were in private schools and they weren't able to meet their needs. Now, these students had special needs, and when they transferred to the public schools, thank God, the public schools had the system in place to be able to meet these students' needs, and that's why public schools exist. But no, we do not test, you know, in a state-mandated legal way, private schools, and that again is because
they're private.
Right. So tell me just, we've got about 30 seconds. What happens now? This needs to be worked out with Congress, and then we'll see a proposal for a new education bill a few months from now, a year from now?
Well, there are 12 funding bills that go through Congress, and these changes in No Child Left Behind or Race to the Top will be embedded in some of those 12. Obama administration is hoping to be able to get some broad coalition, and I think they're looking for a political win to be able to do this and perhaps build other political successes. But it will be with federal funding and the funding bills that this will be based upon.
Thank you so much for being with us. Great interest in the topic, and you're a marvelous guest. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I enjoy being here.
Our guest, Professor Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to John Anderson for answering our many phone calls. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them or all your emails, but if you want to post your comments on Facebook, please feel free to do that, because people are starting to do that and responding to each other, which is what that medium is all about, right? So that's, you go to Facebook, it's The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll have some of your comments posted there. News is coming up, and we have another hour of conversation, so please sure and stay awake for it. This is the Ideas Network.